NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up for Season 10, Episode 18. In this week's episode, we looked into Red Rock and Housen. We evaluated them as suspects. We broke down their witness statements. And as always, that led us down a path to looking at our existing timeline and giving us a second, third look at a lot of the other statements to try to add a little bit more clarity to the case. In the studio here with me today, as always, is Mr. Mike Bussing.
What's up?
And Mr. Zach Weaver.
Howdy.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, before we get started, I did want to let all of you guys know, kind of a last minute thing, but if anybody is available and interested, the True Crime Podcast Festival is on this year. It was supposed to be in Kansas City last year, 2020, obviously got canceled because of the pandemic. Lisa Strawn, who is the one that organizes that event, reached out to me late last week. Asked if I'd be interested in coming and doing a live true crime binge episode. It's going to be tricky. I'm actually going to Houston the week before that to do some work on this case, but we worked it out. I'm going to be there for one day on Saturday, July 3rd. But if you didn't get to go to CrimeCon, or if you did get to go to CrimeCon and you enjoyed it, you should probably check out True Crime Podcast Festival. Again, I said it's in Kansas City. It's the week of 4th of July weekend. It's like the 3rd and 4th. Everything is done by 2 p.m. on the 4th, though, so everybody has time to get home in time for fireworks. Much, much cheaper than CrimeCon. I think the full weekend pass is $150, and they gave me a promo code. So if you really want to go, use promo code RUFF, and you'll get 10% off of that. So you can do the whole weekend for $135. Generation Y guys are going to be there. One of the big draws for me is Josh Hallmark from True Crime Bullshit, the Israel Keys podcast. He's going to be there doing a live show. I wanted to go meet in person and hang out with Josh. Bunch of other True Crime podcasts are going to be there. And this, unlike CrimeCon, is all about the podcast. There's no TV and other people like that there. It's all about podcasts. Get to know the podcasts you listen to, hang out with them, watch some live events. I think there's a big social gathering. There may even be food and then cash bar. Not sure. There's a big social thing on Saturday night, the 3rd, which I'll be there for that. But check it out. The website is truecrimepodcastfestival.com. You can register for the event. Again, if you're interested, if you're going to be around Kansas City or can get there, it's $150, $135 if you use my promo code RUFF. Also, they have the big fancy hotel it's in. They have a block rate that I think expires today, the day you guys are watching this, the 18th, or listening to this, Friday the 18th. The block rate expires today. So if you happen to hear this in the morning on the 18th, hop on to the truecrimepodcastfestival.com website, and you can book a hotel. I think the block rate is like $150, $159 a night, and it'll go up after today to stay in the actual hotel where the event is. But want to let you guys know about that. I would have let you know sooner, but I didn't know about it sooner, so I just found out about it. Hopefully we'll see some of you there. And with that being said, let's move on to our discussion. In this week's episode, like I said, I broke down Red Rock and Housen's statement, which of course led us back to Jen's statements and then even led us back even further into June Sage's statement, which really became eye-opening for me, as you heard on the show, as I began to break it down. Before we get into all of your questions, Zach, do you have anything or any questions?
I think one big thing jumped out to me is I'm curious now, did June maybe really see the true killers? They said she saw two to three black males.
Right.
Through the peephole. We assume that it's the Red Rock interaction. But some of the timeline stuff, we don't really know. I mean, I think she may have seen the real individuals.
It's possible. So I made some kind of leaps without realizing it early on when we first started looking at June's statement. So looking at, and that's why I know there's people that they want to jump ahead and they want to look at more big picture, but there's a reason why we do these hyper-focused looks at each element of the case as it causes us to catch things that we didn't catch before. So originally I read June Sage's statement, right? So I'd been through Jennifer's statements. We heard about the Red Rock interaction, and then we read Red Rock and we read Housen just kind of in, you know, briefly way back when we were first kind of getting the big picture of the story. And then we read June Sage's statement, and it's describing, you know, looks like Jennifer knocking on the door, two or three guys come up and then they leave. That must have been her seeing, you know, in my mind, it went from, well, that could have been to, it was. Certainly that's what she saw. It was the interaction with Red Rock and Housen. And then we have the scream. Where does that fit in? And then there was the question of, well, could the scream could have been somebody screaming upon discovery of the body, and the moving around had been Keith Truesdale moving the flower pot and all that away from the door to get in? Or could it have been that Jen knocking on the door prior to the attack? We talked about back then that didn't seem to make sense, because if it was a targeted attack of Catalina and Jen's job was to knock on the door, why would she knock on the wrong door? It doesn't make sense. You know, if they know, she knows they're going into the patio there, like, how does she end up over on the other door? That doesn't make much sense. Also, Red Rock and Housen, per Jen's statement, come from around the corner by the office, right? So they're coming from the wrong direction and leaving from the wrong direction. And then in her confession, this interaction happens, and her two accomplices are standing. It's just they're standing there by the steps when Red Rock and Housen show up. But Red Rock and Housen say they don't see anybody. Red Rock's actually up the stairs a few steps, doesn't see anybody around. So for a million reasons, it didn't make sense that the interaction with Red Rock and Housen occurred right before the murder, which I still contend is the case. I still don't think that. I think they would have seen the accomplices. Her knocking on the wrong door doesn't make sense. But then as we took a closer look at it, the fact that we think this was Red Rock and Housen was based almost solely on the fact that she described Jennifer, right? Mm-hmm. She described Jennifer and her two-toned hair and her black shirt must have been Jennifer, and therefore that must have been the two killers.
The one thing that sticks out to me with that, after really thinking about it, is the fact that she's looking through a peephole. Like, how right. well can you describe someone through a peephole? You know, I think most listeners and myself, you know, you guys have looked through people. If it's somebody you really, really, truly recognize at the door, you're probably going to recognize
them. Yeah, because it's a fisheye look, right? Yeah. So it's a compressed image at the middle, and then it kind of like gets more distorted as you go around the circle of the people. So like, you might be able to get a really good view of somebody as they're directly outside of your door, but
right in front of the
right
peephole.
In front of the door, right in front of the peephole. But that's it.
Yeah, and so the fact that what jumped out at me was the same thing that jumped out at me with Housen was that she describes that she's got two-toned highlighted hair.
Right.
If you're looking at a peephole look of somebody facing the door, mm-hmm. the two-tone part was in the back. We've seen pictures of the front of Jennifer's hair pulled back. You can't see any highlights. It's her ponytail. It's the back. You couldn't see that through a peephole. You know, and how do you know if somebody's tall or short through a peephole through that fish? You know, there's all those things in there. But originally I thought, well, that must have been Jennifer, and therefore this must have been Red Rock and Housen coming up, because everything fits, right? But it doesn't really fit. As we dig in even closer, again, she says there's two or three. She just says they came in the area and left. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say what direction they came from. I kind of assumed they came from the office, because I assumed she was seeing what Jennifer described. But two or three, they come in and left. Doesn't say anything about one of them being on a bike. Doesn't say anything about one of them climbing up the walking up the stairs. Doesn't say anything about them interacting with Jennifer. And so then it's like, well, so what if that wasn't? Now, a couple things here. Could still be Jennifer, but not Red Rock and Housen. Or it could have not been Jennifer at all and not been Red Rock and Housen. In either one of those instances, now we don't have the same issue. Still the same issue a little bit if it was Jennifer. Because still, why is she knocking on the wrong door? Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't Jennifer, it was a different group of people. Well, then we have, I don't know. It's hard to it just opens up a whole new world. Could it have still been the actual killer, or could it have been the actual the knock on the door and the actual killer's coming? Well, if they came from the other way, it definitely could have been. If they came from the area of the patio and went back, the whole knocking on the wrong door thing, that doesn't make sense for Jennifer, who lives upstairs and is supposedly targeting specifically Catalina. But now if you're talking about a a stranger. So now we're not talking about Eva. We're not talking about Jennifer. We're talking about some stranger, another third party. Them knocking on the wrong door. Maybe it was they were trying to see, could they get into this one or could they get into this one? Maybe they didn't, you know, they came with some other accomplices and they said, go knock on the door. And she didn't know which door to, there's a lot more scenarios that could be opened up. I don't know that she heard or that what she saw was the actual killer, but I definitely don't think that we can say that what she saw was Red Rock and House and Jennifer. And I really, after really thinking a lot and breaking that down during the creation and writing of that episode, I really doubt that who she saw was Jennifer. I really do.
Well, and I think you brought up a good point with House and the bike.
Yeah.
I think that's something, even though you wouldn't be able to describe somebody, if you're looking through people, you could tell that somebody, you know what I mean? If they're holding a bike or straddling a bike, whatever, they would have right. a bike. Like, that would be something you would add, I believe. Especially if you're going to go to the detail of adding, she had two-tone hair and she had a black shirt.
Exactly.
I feel like you would add that detail as well, that, one of the individuals had a bike.
And if not that, the fact they went up the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
Or the fact that they interacted with the girl that was knocking on the door. None of that's in there. None of that happens.
It's very curious.
Yeah, so where does that leave us then with everything?
It really puts things up in the air. I think there's a possibility June Sage maybe did see the actual killers and it had nothing to do with Jennifer or Red Rock or Housen. Maybe not even Eva. You know, I don't know. It just, again, so I had said a month ago, that I found it suspicious that all the eyewitnesses described Jennifer in the exact same way. Just that fact alone is a red flag for me. Like I've said many times, eyewitness identification is the actual absolute worst form of evidence. Eyewitnesses don't get things right. They don't get details right. And you can see it in just about every case where you know, 10 people will witness the same thing happen and describe things happening differently, especially when they're uninvolved parties, right? So that was already a problem. But then I started thinking about the specifics, like we just talked about, the peephole. How did she get in a look so much to know how tall she was and that her hair was two-toned through a peephole? That seems unlikely. And then Housen is even worse. Now Red Rock knows Jennifer. He didn't have to even describe that. He describes the shirt, though. Make sure to say she's wearing a black shirt, which that hadn't occurred to me. I just assumed that must be what she's wearing. Everybody says she's wearing a black shirt. She's wearing a black shirt. But she says, I think she says, I have to go back and look, but I think she says she's wearing a white shirt that morning. And also, I was like, what the fuck? What if she never was wearing a black shirt? What if all of that was manipulated? You know, we're all wondering what happened to the black shirt. And if she was wearing a black shirt, where is it? Why didn't police look for it? Why didn't they get a warrant for her apartment or for Eva's apartment? And the police were in both of those places. Where's this black shirt that supposedly everybody said they saw her wearing when she says she wasn't wearing a black shirt? But then Housen, right? So he's describing her. So it's a north-facing apartment, which means with her under the step, she is absolutely in the shadow. There's a shadow of the apartment over her. Housen says he's looking at her through the steps. He also says that her back's to the door. And again, her hair, the two-tone part of her hair, is her ponytail. So how does he look at through the steps, in the shadows, of somebody who's facing him, and know to point out to police that she had two-tone highlighted hair? I don't believe it. I absolutely don't believe it. I said the only one, we don't get that description from other than the black shirt is Red Rock, but Red Rock didn't have to describe her because he said it was Jen. I know Jen, and that was Jen. But yeah, so I guess your question, could she have witnessed the actual murderers? I think there's a possibility of that. Yeah, for sure.
All right, guys, let's jump into these questions. This one comes from Lauren. What happens to Jennifer's case if we find evidence points to a suspect who is already dead? What is the legal standard in Texas to overturn a conviction?
Well, it just depends. I mean, there's several ways to overturn a conviction. I mean, you have constitutional overthrowing of a conviction or vacating of a conviction. Basically, they say she didn't get a fair trial. So, like, if you discover there was a Brady violation or there was ineffective assistance of counsel, I mean, none of that matters who did it. It doesn't even matter if they're innocent or guilty. It's only based on whether or not they received a fair trial. And then if we're talking about actual innocence exoneration, you have to prove they're innocent, which, you know, as I've said from the beginning, will be tough in this case because we know we've got these two. The tricky part is what was used at trial has to be considered. So at trial, it was presented to the jury that there was two unknown DNA profiles on one of the murder weapons. that did not belong to Jennifer or Catalina. So if we test that and it comes up to be two random people that we don't know, that will not be enough to exonerate her, I don't think. Because her confession, which also was already in evidence, so has to be considered, says there was two other people that did this.
And she said that she didn't commit the murder, that these other two people did.
Right. And the CCA would consider the fact that the jury already knew that there was these two unknown profiles and they convicted anyway. So finding out who those belong to doesn't matter. Now, if you run those two profiles and you find out that one of them is Eva, or one of them is KD, or one of them is Youngster, or one of them is Red Rock, or one of them is Housen, right? So you have somebody that's already a part of the narrative that is now inside touching the murder weapon. That now opens up doors, because now, so you can't say, well, Jennifer's confession stands, and since we have this DNA that shows Eva's DNA on the murder scene, on the murder weapon, that everything's still copacetic, because it's not, because both of those things can't exist. Her confession can't be true, and Eva's DNA on the murder weapon. Those two things cannot exist in the same space. So now you've opened things up. Now we've got a whole different series of questions. The confession can't really be considered because now it's provably false. And then we would work from there. And there's a lot of legal maneuvering that would go from there.
So if you thought it was like, let's say that to either the DNA evidence comes back to like Red Rock or Housen, do you think they could still make an argument that is who she said it was, even though she gave other names?
I think that could be tricky.
Because in my head, I feel like they could still work an argument to say, well, that's the two guys she was with.
Right. So that would depend on how hard the DA would want to fight. Keep in mind, I'm not a lawyer. This isn't legal advice. So this is just my opinion based on what I've seen over the years in these types of cases. Depends on how hard they want to fight, because it's kind of the same problem, right? So Red Rock and Housen are already part of the confession.
Mm-hmm.
And they came from the other way and left from the other way and weren't involved in the murder. So now if their DNA is inside, now again, we've got to take another look back at the confession. Can that still be kept in evidence now that we know it's a false statement? And again, from there, it could go any number of different directions. And then the question was if they're dead. So Red Rock is dead. So if the DNA came back to him, it would be tricky because you can't then question him, as opposed to, let's say it does come back to Red. Let's say we get a DNA test and there's a CODIS hit and we find some person we've never thought of, and they bring them in and question them, and they, obviously their DNA is on the scene and they give a confession as to what actually happened and it didn't involve Jennifer, then that should be enough to exonerate her. Say it comes back to, what was the name of the guy Jennifer said that she was it Frank? In one of her versions, she said that Eva and Frank did it, right? So if it comes back to, and we find out, this is Frank's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And they question Frank, and Frank is like, all right, you got me. It was me and Eva. And they say, was Jennifer involved? And it's like, no, this is what happened. It was me and Eva. We did it. Then, yeah, that would be enough to exonerate her. But so there's a lot of moving parts to go on there. Now, if you find, there's other places. So let's say you find the DNA of, one thing that I really think we need to do is that wallet, right? So you test the wallet and find Eva's DNA on the wallet. Now, if you find Jennifer's DNA on the wallet, it doesn't help her at all and could hurt her really. I mean, just like anything else, right? You could make the argument she picked it up after the fact, blah, blah, blah. She was in the apartment. Maybe she touched it later. But it's probably going to be lights out for her if that's the case. Not necessarily, but probably. But now if you find Eva's DNA on the wallet, Eva, who says she's completely uninvolved, was never in the apartment, never did any of this, has no connection to the crime or the wallet whatsoever, and you find Eva's skin cells on that wallet, then now, again, it's going to open things up again. Is that enough to fully, or it's definitely going to be enough to bring Eva in to question her and possibly arrest her and try her. And then it's going to, all of that will be considered. But this isn't one of those cases where, say a rape and murder case and you have DNA on the scene that's not tested and one person, Zach, you've been arrested and spent 20 years in prison for this. And we run the DNA test and find out that it was Mike's DNA. Then that's pretty simple. You're out. This mm-hmm. is much more complicated than that.
Danny says, is there any chance that Red Rock was not Broderick, but his twin brother, Roderick? That would explain a bit more about why he seemed interested in young Jen, given Roderick's criminal history.
Okay, just to clarify that, as I mentioned, Red Rock has a twin brother named Roderick. And as I said, when I started looking at his criminal history, I was like, oh shit, look at this big laundry list of charges. But as it turned out, those were not Broderick, who is Red Rock. Those were Roderick, his brother, that has the big criminal history. And I think that, you know, that first of all, no is the answer to the question. I think that that causes a lot. You try to take a lot of leaps, like, well, but what if he gave him, you know, what that would mean is, and I thought about it because it's like, well, he's a twin. Maybe he gave him his brother's ID and said, you know, I'm Broderick. But there's no reason for him to do that at that time, right? Because a lot of these charges aren't present. Yeah, you know, they're not an issue yet. And I'd have to look. There's a chance Broderick might have even been in jail at the time. I don't know.
The weird thing is, though, that I think Danny's hitting on, and I can kind of relate to this sort of being a twin myself, is that the name Red Rock seems to coexist better with
Roderick.
Right. And I can't really get over that, because especially with them being twins, it's almost like he's using his brother's nickname. I don't know if I can explain it that well.
No, I'm tracking with what you're saying.
Yeah, so that is kind of hard to get over, that idea. And it would open the door to mistaken identities.
It definitely can. And actually, Danny sent me a message mentioning that. Like, doesn't Red Rock seem more like Roderick? I don't know where that nickname came from. But I guess to put a button on this would be, for me anyway, is as I said, Red Rock's dead. And I think some listeners on our fan page tracked down his obituary. And in the obituary, it says that Broderick, our guy that we're dealing with, that Broderick's nickname was Red Rock. So I think that kind of puts any
I think confusion. In Housen's statement, when he first describes him, he calls him Broderick and then says it's Red Rock.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of layers, and that's what I meant by, like, you gotta make a lot of leaps.
I do see where Danny and Mike are both coming from, because seem like it ties in better. But
yeah, yeah. It's definitely, you wonder, especially when there's a one letter difference, because they have the same middle name. Like, could it be mistaken identity? Could it have actually been Roderick? But there's too much. I mean, the fact that, you know, the obituary says that Broderick's nickname was Red Rock. They all called him Red Rock. Housen says it's my friend Broderick who goes by Red Rock. Everybody's calling, you know, Jen only knew him as Red Rock, but Housen knew him by Broderick also. So yeah, I don't think so. It's not a bad thought. I just think that knowing what we know, we got to take too many leaps to get there.
Colleen says, it's super weird to me that Red Rock knows Jennifer's name, but refers to Eva as, quote, the Mexican girl. Why does he know Jennifer's name?
I mean, I don't know. Think about your neighborhood. Are there people in your neighborhood who you know by name and people in your neighborhood who you don't know by name?
That's true.
Yeah.
It's very, very true. Actually, I live in a small neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably 50-50, other people I know and don't know.
Right.
And you wave to all of them.
Yeah. You can identify them. You know they're the people that live over there mm-hmm. and don't live. It depends on their relationship. You know, obviously, Red Rock and Jennifer have had some enough interaction to where he's learned her name before. And that kind of goes back to what we talked about before, you know, why Red Rock was going to see Eva. It doesn't seem like he was going to visit a friend because he doesn't even know her name.
Carrie says, Jen was seen under the staircase with her back to the door telling people to go away. Doesn't this seem like pretty guilty behavior if the statement is true?
What does back to the door mean, right? So this comes up in Red Rock's written statement a week after Jennifer is arrested. And in this one, in that same statement, now he says, I was going to visit my friend Eva, which is not what he said the first time. And now she's, unlike his first statement, now she's got her back to the door. Didn't say that the first time. So there's, and what does that mean? She's knocking on the door and she heard them approach and just turned around to talk to them. You know, technically that's her back to the door, you know, so it's not like you kind of read it and imagine her, like, you know, pinning her back against the door, like, go away, don't look at what's going on here. But all it means is that she was facing them and talking to them. So I don't think it means anything at all.
Ashley says, will we be hearing anything from friends of Catalina's, other relatives, etc.? Did she have life insurance or a healthy savings account that someone would be the beneficiary of?
I'm hoping so. As I said before, from what Juan told me, all of her old church friends are gone and passed on. He's literally my only contact. I mean, I went to her only relative. I've had people say, you need to do a better job on victimology. I'm like, the hell do you want me to do? She's got one living relative who did talk to me.
Well, and I think you have to put together, too, she was in her 70s when she was murdered,
right?
20 years ago.
Right, 25 years ago.
Yeah, so there's probably not a whole lot of friends still around.
Right. And that's what he said. Because I asked him, you know, is there any of them still around? And he said, they're all gone. So I have no one else to talk to except Juan. And I don't have a phone number for Juan. So I'm, and I don't know if I already mentioned this episode or if that was in the Patreon pre-roll, but I am going back to Houston and it'd be about a week and a half from when you guys hear this. I have a trip planned. One of the things on that trip is to try to go talk to Juan again, ask some of those questions. He did tell me, as he put it, she didn't have any money. So I don't think there was any kind of big savings account. Maybe there was life insurance. I kind of doubt that too. You know, people don't typically have life insurance on themselves unless they have someone who depends on them. She didn't work. She didn't have a, you know, she didn't have a job. So she was, it wasn't like she had something provided by her employer. So I don't know. It's possible. I'll ask about that. But even keep in mind, even when she was killed, Juan was her only living relative. Remember, she never married, or I think he said that she did for a minute way back when, but never had any kids. So she, you know, she doesn't have any children to be dependents or beneficiaries. You know, she just lived with her nephew. The whole thing. Her parents were gone. She had her sister who died the year before, and she had her sister's son, one son, Juan, who she lived with for most of her adult life, and that was her entire circle right there. Juan always kind of just took care of her.
Lynn says, have you contacted any of the local news channels to see if they have any archived footage with interviews at the scene? I can see at least 3 or 4 stations ready with cameras and microphones in the crime scene video. Possibly even a news person still is working today that was at the scene interviewing neighbors. I also don't see anyone in a white muscle shirt as Peekert reported Howson was wearing, especially near his bike or near Red Rock in the crime scene video.
As far as the news stations, I thought about giving it a try. I've never, ever had any luck with that in the past. No one has been interested or open to giving up that archival footage, or they don't have it. Usually anytime I've had any luck is if someone of you listeners actually has some connections within one of those news stations. So if that's the case and you're listening, please reach out and we can try it. As far as Howson goes, I think I was in this episode where I said what my theory about where the whole mic thing came from. And that's what I think happened. So if memory serves, you can see Howson's bike in the crime scene video, but you don't see Howson in the video. You see Red Rock standing there very clearly describing, you know, wearing what he's supposedly wearing, but no Howson. So my thought was that when Red Rock gives his oral interview and he says, I was here with my buddy Mike, I don't know where he's at, that then that officer goes asking around about Mike, comes across Youngster and asks if he knows where Mike is. KD hears that. And again, this is just a theory, so this is not fact. But this is what I think probably happened, that KD hears that. And then when KD's trying to create this false narrative when he gives his statement, he adds in, kind of throws in as almost an afterthought that, oh, and I heard her say, let go of me, Mike, because all KD knows is the police are looking for a guy named Mike. So maybe, you know, he should point them in the direction of a Mike, because he did hear someone say Mike. But I think that's where that came from, was the fact that, like you said, Howson wasn't on the scene right then when all the officers were there, but his bike was, so he was around the area somewhere. And I think they were just looking for Mike to get a statement from him.
Lynn's next question, have you made an attempt to contact the responding EMS personnel?
Working on it. Yeah, I have their names. I've been working on tracking them down.
Sarah says, is it possible to find out if Howson had a juvenile record or what kind of reputation he had in the community when Catalina was murdered?
That's also another reason for my trip to Houston. I've got some people I'm trying to contact. A major reason for this trip, other than talking to Juan for me, is I think I've got a good handle on things now and kind of a list of who I think might have some information to talk to about some of that background stuff. Phone numbers and my sources are typically not right, and people generally are much more open to speaking when you knock on their door as opposed to when you call them and they can easily just hit a button and hang up on you.
So one thing I just thought about as you're talking about this, and you talk about possibly trying to reach out to the EMS, the first responders.
Uh-huh.
What would you go in asking? Because I feel like that's such a generic person to ask, because as you were a first responder, you've seen a lot. So I feel like it'd be hard to recall anything from a particular event 25 years ago.
So what I would ask them is, because I've thought a lot about this, is, you know, what would trigger a memory in me out of the thousands of EMS calls I've been on in my life? I would first ask, do you guys ever remember going to the Green Arbor Apartments to a murder? Because so you run a lot of calls, but not a lot of murders.
Okay.
And so I'd be like, you know, it came in as an EMS call, was an elderly lady, ended up being stabbed stabbed to death. It was a murder. Does that ring a bell? I've had luck with some of that before. Season two, Elnora Griffin. I tracked down the first responder, firefighter first responder that went. And, when I kind of just gave him a little bit of the, and he's like, the place had the pond back there. I remember going back and yeah.
Okay.
And he remembered it. Good chance, city of Houston's very busy. Mm-hmm. Good chance the answer to that question is, dude, I've run 100 murders in my life. I don't remember.
And that's just what I was wondering, because I just feel like, I've heard you talk to me off record about cases,
right?
Not about them, but talking about how many cases you've been to. And I just feel like it'd be really hard to narrow it down to a certain case that you worked on 25 years ago.
Right.
With any reliability.
Yeah. Certainly they're not going to be like, oh yeah, I remember we got dispatched at 9:12 and I remember, but maybe to just get a feel of the scene or the procedures back then, or why would there have been, again, I'm still wrestling with this 27 minute time. I think we're missing something. If I had a guess, I think of all the different information we have that's given us the timeline that we're working with, the most solid time, I think, is when the police were dispatched. We have a very clear in the report that Officer Peekert first on scene, working off the top of my head, but someone called 911 and reported a DOA at 9:42, dispatched at 9:44, arrived on scene at 9:48 or whatever. That's the most solid time that I think that we have. That's when police were dispatched and they already knew they were going to a dead body. The other time we have on the front end of that is time of death was pronounced by EMS personnel on scene at 9:15. That's in the ME's report. That I think is, I feel like if there's a mistake, that's where it is. Because as I said before, it's hearsay, right? It's mm-hmm. on a report, but it's hearsay. So you got one report saying what another report that we don't have says.
Well, I think we came to that conclusion last season with the Courtney's case where we talked about the lividity.
Right.
And it said one thing, but I think we came to the conclusion that that was just a typo.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to remember the details, but yeah.
They said lividity was one way, but she was laying the other way, and we believed
that she had been moved. Yeah, that's when we had Dr. Wecht come on, who scared the hell out of me. scary guy. Yeah, so I don't even remember what this question was, but going on to my thought there, yeah. I really feel like, it was about contact the EMS person. Yeah, so they're not going to give us times, but they may be able to say like, oh yeah, maybe it rings a bell, but I have cases that stick out in my head that I can tell you every detail about, not times, but if I was like, well, why, it seems like there was like a half hour after you pronounced her dead, you guys called the police and be like, oh, I remember. Yeah. We were packing up. And then, somebody was like, is that a stab wound? And we went back, something like that. But I'm not super confident we'll get anything out of that, but it sure would be nice because again, I just don't, a lot of people on the fan page after last week have come up with different thoughts and theories on why or how they might have went back. Because, again, my issue is I don't see a reason for them to go back to the body to make that determination after they've called it dead. But I just don't see it. If I had to guess, and it's just a guess, my guess is that 9:15 time of death is not accurate, that it's probably closer to 9:30 or after that is my guess. And that's strictly based on a hunch. And the fact that I can't make sense of the EMS movements with a 9:15 time of death and a 9:42 call the police.
Pike says, do we know if the detectives asked Jen during all of her statements what Eva told her to lie about? This goes back to the beginning and is pretty basic, but I don't remember hearing it anywhere. It's just a basic question that might be really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, which is not a reliable source at all, but in Crime Watch Daily, we hear her say that Eva told her to say, I think we hear her say that Eva told her to say that she was outside when the screaming happened. And she says she wasn't out there when that happened. I believe I should have looked at that question before we started because I'd have to go back to her statement. But I mean, for your own research, go back and look at not Jennifer's first police statement on her website, not her first written statement, not her confession or her second written statement, but look at, there's a file in the case documents that is Alan's reports on Jennifer's interview where he talks about the different versions of events she gave. And that's where she says, well, she only said that because Eva told her to. And in my mind, she was talking about the fact that she was there when all of the screaming happened and that she really wasn't, but I'd have to go back and review that to be sure.
Lindsay says, Bob, can you clarify further what you were saying about how everyone had the same description of Jen, but maybe it was actually a different description. I think you were implying that maybe Eva was the one the neighbor saw knocking on the door.
No, I'm not implying at all that it was Eva. I kind of implied it. I posed what if what June had said was that it was a black female in her 20s wearing a collared shirt. I posed that because that's what Zaragoza Garza actually saw. That's what he testified to, even though Swainson wrote in his report that he said he saw the girl with the black shirt and the two-toned hair, like everyone else. I was just saying if, you know, as we're paralleling those two, what if that's what she actually said, then what would we think? And because we see Eva sitting at the top of the stairs in the crime scene video wearing a collared shirt is the only reason I mentioned that. But no, I'm not necessarily saying that it was Eva she saw. All I'm saying is that we've been banking on the fact that June Sage is a reliable witness here and witnessed something that was either connected to the crime or occurred right after. And the whole time we're thinking that who she saw was Jennifer. But I think it's very, very unlikely that she described who she saw in the way that she saw it. And I think it's even more unlikely that she described the interaction with Red Rock and Housen when there were two guys rolled up, one on foot, one on a bike. One of them walks halfway up the stairs. They're standing there talking to Jennifer and then goes back down the stairs and they ride away on foot and bike. And that she just describes two or three black men that just come into the area and then leave the area. So I think what it does is it opens up a lot more questions. You know, not necessarily did she see Jennifer interacting with Red Rock. I think she could have seen some other person, some probably female, maybe even not female, knocking on her door, and some black men that could have been or maybe could not have been Jennifer and Red Rock and Housen. So it's just opening up. I'm just blabbering now, but it's just opening up a whole new world of possibilities as to what she actually witnessed. And what I'm definitely not saying is that I think she saw Eva. I'm not saying there's no evidence to support that whatsoever. I was just giving a hypothetical based on what Zaragoza said he saw. So I'm not saying that I think she saw Eva. I'm saying that I don't think she saw Jennifer, or at least that I don't think she described Jennifer in the way that it's documented in the report.
Our last question comes from Angela. Do you have a picture of the view from June's apartment? Could she even see the stairs or the sidewalk where the bike was from her door?
I don't have a picture of the view, but you can see by looking at photos in the video, like the angles she would have. I don't think she could see through the peephole. Now, again, it is that fisheye, fishbowl type lens, so maybe she could have seen somebody over at Catalina's door. I think if you could, you couldn't really see much, but she did have a straight angle out to from her door. You know, the peephole will distort it, but from her door, she could see right there at a straight line right to the foot of the steps that go up to Eva's apartment right there. She had a clear view of that and everything happening out in front of there. So she would have been able to see everything that happened in that general area.
Okay, that's it for questions. Thanks, everybody, for your thoughts and theories.
All right, yep, thank you, everybody. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, if you're around the Kansas City area and are interested in attending the True Crime Podcast Festival, that website is truecrimepodcastfestival.com. Use our code RUFF and you'll get 10% off of that. And I hope to see a bunch of you guys there. Any other announcements? True Crime Binge this week. I had all three of the hosts from the Piketon Massacre. Season 2 of that podcast just went live. Fascinating story, fascinating and well-produced podcast. I had all three of the hosts on there. And other than that, wish my daughter luck, who, as you're listening to this, will be playing in her state semifinal softball tournament. And with that being said, if Sunday's episode's a little shorter than normal, that's because they keep winning and I keep having to drive to the middle of the state to go watch and cheer my daughter on. And make sure you tune in on Sunday, where I will be. I can't believe nobody complained about this. The big cliffhanger at the end of this episode. We're going to be breaking all that down and more on Sunday. Have a great week, guys. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show is created and composed by PutThemInASong.com.
Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of createdintandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd really like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, Truth and Justice Pod. Just click the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING, and Zach is at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.